Have joined the court. Welcome, Judge Jacobson. Counsel, Mr. Kunitz.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. You may approach, and before you begin, Mr. Vince?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Kunitz, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Kunitz, and along with Jamie Tyler, we represent the appellant, DMU Properties, LLC. First issue I want to raise before the court is that the district court erred in allowing live testimony at a summary judgment, be it also that that live testimony was presented without notice to DMU. If you look at the case law, a lot of our briefing focused on First National Bank versus Green, and if you look at that case, it says that the summary judgment procedures are established by statute. And in doing so, you look at two statutes or two court rules to decide how the summary judgment
procedure. Does the statute actually limits?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can in?
Yes, the Nebraska Revised Statute 25-1332 limits the evidence that may be received on a motion for summary judgment to depositions, answers to interrogatories, admissions, stipulations, and affidavits. And that's a direct quote from the statute.
When it uses before those words, the word includes, what have we said about the exclusivity of the use of the word includes, particularly viewed in the light of the statutory change to Section 25-1332, which used to not use the word includes?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look back to the First National Bank case, which is still good law,
it was under the old statute, wasn't it?
Correct, Your Honor. It was. But what the consistency throughout the case law is that the summary judgment procedure is not supposed to be turned into a mini trial. And in this case, I know that the appellee argues that the evidence of, or the testimony of Ms. Sweeney was simply foundational evidence. It's still subject to cross-examination. So if the court looks at the amendments to 1332.
I'll let you finish, but
yep.
You don't disagree that it was foundational in nature, do you?
I don't disagree that it was initially offered to be foundational, but then Ms. Sweeney was briefly cross-examined. So I think the danger zone for the court is if the court
by
says,
your client.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
Yes, correct.
Does the judge have to allow cross-examination?
I think for a due process purpose, cross-examination should always be allowed. I know we're talking a civil matter here, but yes, if a witness is put up on the stand, counsel should have a right to cross-examination.
How have the federal courts interpreted this language?
Which language, Your Honor?
The language that apparently we have adopted statutorily that came from federal.
From the federal rules, Your Honor. I have not looked into that issue, Your Honor. We just focused our analysis on Nebraska precedent. And so if you look at the issue, Justice Castle, summary judgment, the amendments to 1332, there's nothing that we could find that says these amendments now allow live testimony, which could turn this into a mini trial. The problem, too, Your Honor, going back before the fact that we had live testimony here, is that if you look at the amendments, which say you have to submit your index of evidence either in support or in opposition to.
Did you do that?
What?
Did your client submit the index of evidence?
It did not, Your Honor.
Okay. What impact, if any, does that have on this issue?
And we did not handle that portion of the state of that, Your Honor.
But
for appellate purposes, Your Honor, it's our position that that is irrelevant. And the reason for that is if you look at the appellee's index of evidence, it did not have that either an affidavit or live testimony of Ms. Sweeney would be offered. So you don't even get to what DMU did or did not do. You go back to the fact that DMU walks into the summary judgment procedure, it sees that there's some documents that are going to be offered, does not say that Ms. Sweeney's affidavit was going to be offered, it does not say that Ms. Sweeney's live testimony was going to be offered.
Were some of the documents that were offered and ultimately received into evidence self-authenticating?
I think they would have been, yes.
Which ones?
I believe that I don't have the full list of the documents in front of me, Your Honor.
But the construction liens?
Yeah, the construction liens would be.
Anything else?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that would take the foundational testimony from someone from KSI. to lay foundation for those documents. And an important point on those construction liens, though, that they're self-authenticating is, kind of leads to a second argument that there's a factual dispute about those liens and the amounts of the liens. So that kind of carries over to the second point.
Was that factual dispute about the amount of the liens something that sort of rises up from the cross-claim that your client filed?
Yes.
And was that cross-claim litigated in the motion for summary judgment? Was it part and parcel of what was before the court on summary judgment?
Everything was decided before the court on summary judgment, Your Honor.
And did you offer any evidence at all?
Yes. The evidence that, there were two affidavits that were offered. One was from Matt McKeever, who was the formal, the attorney at the trial level. And the other affidavit was from Nick Muhavich.
Didn't both affidavits say, and I'm going to quote it so I don't get it wrong, at this time, DEMU is unable to present by affidavit the facts it needs to justify its opposition to the motion for summary judgment, end quote.
That's correct, Your Honor. But if you read on in the affidavits, if you look to the affidavits, they state that we were not provided with the change orders that were reduced the amount of the active spine contract. There were failed to account for a check, and that we were also not provided with the architect's certificate of payments. And so if you look at the record, if you even look at the record before the court, that the documents that were, the foundation was laid for by Ms. Sweeney, if you look at that, and then if you also take Mr. Muhavich's affidavit, Mr. McKeever's affidavit, there were issues of fact before the court.
And your position on appeal is that there were genuine issues of fact with respect to the amount of the construction lien?
Yes, and where that focuses on is there were different contracts. There was a work order contract.
Based on the accounting of it all, correct?
Correct. Based on the accounting, then also based on the accounting, the application of payments, then which also plays into some of the contracts, or one of the contracts had an interest provision, the other contracts did not have an interest provision. So there's issues of fact as to the amounts of the liens and how the amounts were accounted for, Your Honor.
I want to ask you a quick question about Stephen Gray.
Okay.
Was Mr. Gray served in this case?
Was he served?
Was he served with summons and a copy of the complaint?
I am unaware, Your Honor.
Does that matter to us?
I don't think it does, because I still go back to my first argument that live testimony was accepted. So we don't even get into the accounting on the summary judgment.
I'm going to be more transparent with my question. I'm worried about whether the appeal has been taken from a final judgment.
Okay.
I'm worried about whether the order granting summary judgment addressed all the claims against all the parties. Can you help me with how the claim against Stephen Gray and then the cross-claim that your client brought against Stephen Gray was resolved by the motion for summary judgment?
Well, and to the court's point, not sure. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Can you point me to anything in the record that suggests that claim was either expressly or implicitly addressed in the court's orders?
I don't think there was. The court's order on the summary judgment was pretty short. I think it was 2 to 3 pages, and it mainly focused on the accounting or the amounts that were owed under the construction liens and granted that. And so I don't think that specific issue, Your Honor, was addressed by the court.
Does anything else matter if it was? If we don't have a final judgment, does anything else you're here to argue about matter?
No, if you don't have a final order, it goes back to the trial court for some sort of issue, first to address the claim against Mr. Gray, and then presumably we would have to have that claim addressed, and then we would probably be back up here if that claim is addressed against Mr. Gray, whichever way that's decided, arguing these same issues here. But you don't even get there if there was not a final appealable order, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So I do want to address 1332, though, because I do think that potentially has, you know, wider implications here. Looking at the case law as it sits currently in the state of Nebraska, there's nothing that explicitly allows live testimony at a summary judgment proceeding. And I think even though the First National Bank case is prior to the amendments, if you look at the case law and the 1332, and then if you also look at Nebraska Court Rule 6-1526, it's clear that the courts do not want summary judgments to turn into mini trials, because where that would potentially go is I'm just going to put on my index of evidence in support of my motion for summary judgment that I'm going to call Joe Smith, Bill Smith, and a third person. I'm not going to have to say what they testify about. I'm not going to have to say any of that. Then when I go to my statement of material facts, I'm going to say, you know, fact ABC, and I'm just going to cite the testimony of Mr. Smith. The purpose of these summary judgment rules was to kind of tweak what we had to say, you have to make what you're offering a little more clear. You have to put pinpoint citations to the evidence, but there's nothing in those procedures that changes the case law and the precedent that the court has here today. We say allowing live testimony.
Should the allowance of live testimony be a case-by-case determination? Should the trial court judge have the discretion to make those decisions?
Right, and I thought about that, Your Honor, and no, don't think so, because I think your docket will become a lot more heavy, I think, if the trial court has discretion, because where do you draw that line? Because if you have a case where the trial court says, I'm going to allow you simply to testify for foundational purposes, but I'm going to allow you to be cross-examined, where's that cross-examination going to go? Do we have reversible error? It's just, I think we have create a lot more appellate issues if the trial courts are given discretion to allow live testimony in a summary judgment proceeding. And with that, I see my time is up, so I thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Vint, good morning to you.
Good morning, Judge. Thank you. Last time I was in front of this court, I had COVID. It was remote, so I'm happy to be here live. May it please the court, I had a whole spiel set out, but I'm going to go ahead and kind of skip to the chase. I think the court hit on a few of the issues that are fundamental here. First off, the argument based off the First National Bank case comes from a case that was before the amendment to 1332. 1332 sub 2 allows for additional evidence to be included in a summary judgment beyond the affidavits, depositions, etc., that the original 1332 included. More importantly, 1332 sub 3 allows the court discretion to correct any issues with the evidence as presented at summary judgment. 1332 sub 3 specifically states that if a party fails to properly support an assertion of fact or address another party's assertion of fact as required by subsection 2, the court may give an opportunity to properly support or address the fact. If the court reviews the transcript from the hearing, the court will see that that's exactly what happened here. DMU did not comply with 1332. They didn't provide, or 1526 for that matter as well. They didn't provide a statement beforehand. They didn't provide a brief as required by the court's order. Instead, they showed up at the hearing and threw a bunch of evidentiary objections against the wall, hoping that something would stick. In response, the district court correctly, based off of subsection 3, allowed for my client to correct the record, namely by providing limited testimony to provide foundation in the response to the objections that were untimely filed at the time of the hearing. It's that simple. We're not here to make mini trials out of summary judgment. We're here to provide substantive testimony to support the record or to support an opposition. We're simply here to correct an issue that came up because DMU failed to comply with the actual rule. Therefore, the action of Judge Burns here was correct.
Can I ask you to address the jurisdictional issue?
The one with Gray?
Yeah, Mr. Gray. Yeah, was sure. He served?
He was served, Your Honor. In fact, he was at the hearing. I talked to him afterwards. He was sitting in the gallery, but he was actually at the hearing watching. Mr. Gray was served.
Is there anything in our record that suggests that either there was a default judgment entered against Mr. Graves or that the court ruled on Mr. Graves, the validity of his construction lien or the amount, if any, to which he was entitled, or the cross-claim that DMU raised saying, you can't record a construction lien on that? Anything.
There's nothing in the record on that front, Your Honor. I will say that the effective effect of the judgment, for lack of a better term, is that Mr. Gray's construction lien is essentially nullified because the full amount that was in the interpleader action was paid out to the construction.
Was it ever litigated?
It was not ever litigated. He didn't appear in the case. He never actually entered a formal appearance. There was never, our motion didn't bring it up.
The summary judgment motion didn't go to any cross-claim that DMU raised against Mr. Gray.
Right, it was just our motion and then their counterclaim against us as a result.
So he served, Mr. Gray served?
Mr. Gray was served, yes.
Party?
Yeah, he was served as a party. And he, and he.
And what is the, and then, just to simplify, only for me evidently, what's the disposition as to Gray?
There is no disposition as to Gray in the actual.
Is there an implicit disposition?
There is, Your Honor, and the reason there is that there's a finite amount of money that was being bought over here. Essentially, it's an interpleader action, right? There was an amount that was left over after the original sale.
Can I ask you about that?
Yes.
So there was a certain sum that was deposited into court for the court to determine the priority of payment and the entitlement to payment under the Trust Deeds Act, correct? Of the excess sale proceeds.
Correct.
With that finite amount that was paid into court, can you help me understand why the judge then entered judgment in favor of the construction defendants for an amount in excess of what was deposited? Why does the judgment exceed the amount of available proceeds to distribute?
I believe that the judgment, as was originally entered, included interest that was due on the contracts between the parties, but that was actually revised by the revised order after the motion to vacate. The court removed that actual additional excess judgment and left it.
Removed the deficiency judgment, but didn't alter in any respect the judgment or the amount of the judgment entered in favor of the construction defendants, and that still exceeded by a significant sum, the amount available to distribute.
That's correct.
What do we do about that?
Frankly, Your Honor, we've essentially rested on the amount that we received out of the interpleader action and haven't pursued the further judgment and don't intend to. So I don't really mind whatever the court wants to do with the excess judgment. It's not our intent to try to collect it. There's no money left in deeming as far as.
Well, my question is whether it was plain error in an interpleader action to enter a judgment in favor of some parties for an amount in excess of the sums available, the sums that have been deposited with the court.
I don't believe it's plain error in that it wasn't a full-on interpleader judge. It was under the Trust Deeds Act. But the effect of the judgment was to treat it essentially as a quasi-interpleader and allow for that money to be paid out to the parties. Whether the court decided there was an excess amount that was due to the parties or not,
how does one apportion that amount?
I believe the full amount that's due to my clients, the subcontractors, was decided by the court to be in excess of the amount that was actually being held by the court. The court then released the amount that was actually being held by the court to my clients for distribution. And that's how we essentially handled the issue.
I want to return to the claim against Mr. Gray or Mr. Gray's claim.
Sure.
You concede, I take it, that the orders do not expressly dispose of that claim.
I agree, yes.
In response to the Chief Justice's question, you said they implicitly did. But didn't we reject the notion of such an implicit disposition in Malolepsky v. State?
That I don't know, Judge. I'll be completely honest with you. I don't know if that.
Let's assume that we did.
Okay.
Now where are we?
I believe that there is a jurisdictional issue to this court with regard to Mr. Gray's claim.
Fair enough. Thank you.
I would agree with that. Very quickly, Judge Hevigan, to address one issue you brought up as far as the federal rules and how it would apply here. There's a fundamental difference in the way that summary judgment is being handled in Nebraska, even after 1332's amendment and how a federal summary judgment is typically applied, in that there usually isn't an evidentiary hearing. Usually the documents that they've been exchanged in discovery, unless there's an objection raised in the briefing, are admitted without any affidavits or any further support for foundation. The exercise of having counsel appear, put on evidence of foundation, put on evidence to address any other evidentiary issue simply isn't part of the federal summary judgment process in most circumstances.
But it still is part of our statutory scheme.
It is, and so we have to address it here. But the question of whether or not the federal court addresses what happened here, they really don't, because the issue here doesn't ever really come up. Finally, I'm running a little bit low on time, so I got a little bit left, to address the issue of the actual substance of the decision. It's a bunch of non sequiturs. It's a bunch of red herrings. This, again, is essentially a trustee's action that became a quasi-interpleader based off of liens which have not really been challenged in any way, shape, or form. Bring up contract issues, bringing up issues of whether or not the accounting is incorrectly. One was addressed by the court in its decision. There isn't any real issue here. Allegations do not create that issue. But two, more importantly, the liens are all the liens of the subcontractors are all rolled into the general contractor lien. There's one amount that's at issue here, and that's the amount of the general contractor.
I beg your pardon, there's one amount, and it'll be divvied up until it's been extinguished.
Correct, one amount, and it did, and it was. All of my clients all have the money.
And if you didn't get all you sought, that's the way it is.
Right.
In awarding interest?
Yes.
The district court used the 16% interest that was referenced in one of the, in the active spine contract, correct? And as I understand, I had to do a little reverse engineering of the math, but as I understand the court's math, it awarded 16% interest on the lien amount, on the total lien amount, all the way up through the date of the summary judgment order. Am I correct on that?
That's correct, yes.
What is the legal authority for entering an award of judgment or an award of interest beyond the time frame? Don't we freeze everything on the date of the trustee's sale? Isn't it the amount of the construction liens on the date of the sale and not the date that summary judgment was entered?
It would be, Judge, except for the fact that this was essentially a liquidated claim, as the court decided. So there wasn't any good faith basis for why it was.
But this wasn't a breach of contract action to recover the remaining sums due under the contracts. This was an equitable interpleader action to decide who gets the excess sale proceeds, correct?
Well, the original action was, but the cross-claim filed by my clients essentially was a breach of contract action, Your Honor. It was that we were not paid.
But the relief you asked was simply to give us the sums to which we are entitled and that will be deposited into court. You didn't ask for all sums due under the contract. This wasn't a breach of contract action.
Your Honor, in the cross-claim against Active Spine and against DMU, we raised it as a breach of contract action.
And what relief did you seek?
We sought relief of what was due to us under the contract as being held by the court.
Can we rely on your pleading for the relief you sought?
You absolutely could, Your Honor. Thank you. Barring any other questions, I see I'm out of time. Thank you all.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Core Bank versus Allied Construction Services. Hence, you are excused and the court is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.